Well, welcome back to all of you Bible students, and welcome particularly to Lesson 5, The Law and the Christian. This lesson begins a series of lessons that really are one of my favorite subjects. It goes all the way back to 1958, and when I first began to listen to Herbert W. Armstrong and Garner Tidd Armstrong on the radio in those years, and learned for the first time that the law of God, which I never had thought much about, I had been a Protestant. I had taken the Protestant point of view. I assumed that much of the law had been done away with. I didn't really know why, but I learned from Herbert W. Armstrong and Garner Tidd Armstrong that that was not true, that it had not been. And once I learned that and began to study the law, all sorts of things began to come clear to me that had not been clear to me before in the Bible. The Bible began in very critical ways to make sense. Now, there were still problems. There were, and I questions of what laws do you keep, how do you keep them, how do you deal with them, what do you do about them? These questions I still had to work with, but at least coming to the understanding that I could not dismiss the Old Testament as just simply the law was done away and I don't have to think about it anymore was a revelation to me. And so in these lessons, I want to share that revelation with you and lay some groundwork for you to understand the law and to know how it is that you can make a decision that you're going to keep this law, or that you can't keep that law, that it doesn't really apply in one way or another, and help you to understand the basis for it, why it is really true. The lesson begins by asking a simple question. How is a person to know the difference between right and wrong? Because really this lies right at the root of the question. What is right and what is wrong? What kind of conduct is right? What kind of conduct is wrong? What is a right way to worship God? What is a wrong way to worship God? This is not a very hard question, as I've said in the lesson. It's just not very often asked. We all have a generalized idea of right and wrong, but we rarely give a thought where that idea came from or what authority lies behind it. Who says that stealing is wrong while honoring your parents is right? Well, we take it for granted. If you were to ask 100 people, is it wrong to steal? They would say, well, of course it's wrong to steal. I think you'd get 100 out of 100 that would say that. Maybe some of them would say, well, there might be exceptions and so forth. But in the main, they would realize it's wrong to steal. You'll find that's true even in societies that don't follow the Bible. Then if you turn around and ask them, well, should a man honor his father and his mother? And you'll get 100 people out of 100, I think, who will agree that that is a right conduct. But how do we know that? Who says it's so? What lies at the root of it? Well, the Ten Commandments say, honor your parents. They say, thou shalt not steal. But why should you follow the Ten Commandments? Many people believe that the Ten Commandments were done away with. One fellow told me, he said, the Ten Commandments were done away with, and 9 of them were reinstituted in the New Testament. Well, what do you need to do away with them for if you're going to reinstitute them, was the question that came to my mind. Now, as I said in the lesson, this is not a trivial question. Because the Old Testament, with all of its laws, is not done away, even though some people believe that it was. They tell us that the Old Testament is like a road map you'd use to get from Texas to California. When you get to California, you don't need the road map any longer. The Ten Commandments were fine for their day, they say, but they passed away with the Old Covenant. Well, is that true? Can we prove it? Is it something we can establish? If we can do without the Ten Commandments now, or the law of God now, why couldn't Israel have done without them as easily as you and I could do without them? Any law that can be abolished probably wasn't necessary in the first place. Think about that. When Congress repeals a law, it is usually because it didn't work. Now, if you apply that question to the Ten Commandments, would God have repealed the law against stealing because it didn't work? I'll grant you it didn't, in one sense of the word, because even though the law sat there and said, thou shalt not steal, there were still a lot of thieves abroad in the land through nearly every generation of man. Well, we will begin to study in this lesson our assumptions about biblical law to see if they are true. We're going to search out the reason why the law was given in the first place, what God expected it to accomplish, and then we will go on from there. The first passage of Scripture we're going to deal with is the 119th Psalm. It begins, blessed are the undefiled in the way, who walk in the law of the Lord. Blessed are they that keep his testimonies, and that seek him with the whole heart. They do no iniquity, they walk in his ways. The word iniquity, by the way, simply means lawlessness. It's means that a person who is not interested in the law. When you come to the Greek word for it, it actually is formed by putting a negative in front of the word for law. Anomia, in other words, no law, or alaw in your approach and outlook to life. The psalmist goes ahead and says, "You have commanded us to keep your precepts diligently. Oh, that my ways were directed to keep your statutes. I really wish," says the psalmist, "that my ways were really directed, that I really was good at it, that it was a natural thing for me to do to keep your statutes. I would not be ashamed when I have respect unto all your commandments. I will praise you with uprightness of heart when I shall have learned your righteous judgments. I will keep your statutes. Oh, forsake me not utterly." And so we begin, and the question is asked, number one, if a young man wanted to live a clean life, to what standard might he look? Verse 9, "Wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed thereto, according to your word." Now that's a really simple passage. You come across a young man, or let's say that you are a young man or a young woman in life, and you're out there living your life. You're going to college, you're at work in some city somewhere, and you take a look at your life. It's not working. You're not happy with yourself. You're not happy with your conduct. You'd like to clean up your act. It's a modern expression. It's not that modern, because the psalmist says, how can a young man clean up his act, cleanse his way? How can you clean up your act? His answer, by taking heed thereto according to your word. In other words, take a moment. Sit down somewhere, have a cup of coffee, put your feet up, stare off into space for a while, and think about your life in the light of and according to the Word of God. Compare what you do with what the Word of God says is right and what the Word of God says is wrong. It's an essential first step toward cleaning up your act, getting your life right back on the standard. So question number one, to what standard might he look? Two, thy word. Now, to what end might a man memorize portions of Scripture? Continue to read in verse 10, "With my whole heart have I sought you. Don't let me wander from your commandments. Your word have I hid in my heart, that I might not sin against you." Well, to hide God's word in your heart is to internalize it, in the modern term, to memorize it, to so familiarize yourself with it that it comes to mind whenever you face a life situation that challenges God's law, or challenges right, or that challenges right or wrong in your life. So, by internalizing thy word, as he uses it here, or the law of God, in your mind, in your heart, it's a protection against sinning. He continues in this passage to say, this short segment, you notice that the 119th Psalm is broken up into 8 verse segments, each of them designated by a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. In this segment, he continues, "Blessed art thou, O Lord, teach me thy statutes. With my lips I have declared all the judgments of your mouth. I have rejoiced in the way of your testimonies as much as in all truth." Now he says, "With my lips I have declared all your judgments." This suggests either an oral recitation or a confession publicly of some sort. I suspect what he means is oral recitation. Memorization and oral recitation. "I have rejoiced in the way of your testimonies as much as in all riches. I will meditate in your precepts and have respect unto your ways. I will delight myself in your statutes. I will not forget your word." Now, question number three is, how many synonyms for law or kinds of law can you find in this chapter? Make a list of them and then leave a space for definition of them later. We're already going to get to definitions, not in this lesson so much as we are in the next one. But you should have now a list, from having read your way through the 119th Psalm, of the different synonyms for law that you find in this passage. Jewish tradition comments on the fact that there are 10 commandments, and in the 119th Psalm there are 10 words for law. In other words, the 10 commandments, by the way, are called the 10 words. And then in the book of Psalms, the 119th Psalm, you have 10 words for law in this particular psalm, an interesting byplay. Now, the interesting question for you will be, did you get 10, or did you get more? I have not consulted to see particularly what the Jewish tradition says those 10 words are, but let's work our way through the list here real quickly before we go on with the psalm. You probably will have noticed, by the way, that there is hardly a verse in this psalm that does not use a word, a synonym, or a descriptor for the law of God. It will speak of it, of the law, or the way, or God's testimonies, His precepts, His statutes, His commandments, His judgments, His words, His righteousness. Now that's 9 right there. Do those match up with yours? Now, the next one, the 10th one, is a little more awkward. There are 2 different candidates for it in my own reading. One of them is the truth, and the other one is thy mouth, because you will find in the definitions that we will give later of the commandments of God that often the mouth of God, in other words, doing something by the mouth of God, is translated to do something by the commandments of God. So the mouth of God is, whatever God speaks is our command, isn't it? So since His word is our command, or what comes from His mouth is our command, then it seems appropriate for that to be one of them. Now, you may also have written down knowledge and understanding as 2 other items, and you could easily come to that. Knowledge and understanding, though, seem to be more the results of the law rather than descriptors of the law, but they really are synonymous. The law is understanding, and the law is knowledge. Of that, there can be little doubt. Question number 4 asks where the psalmist went customarily for advice and for counsel. Well, where do you go for advice? Generally speaking, we have good friends. We like to talk to them. If we face a difficult question, a problem, we want someone to talk it over with, to get advice from, to get counsel from, or to at least test our own counsel. In other words, I believe I ought to do this. Am I looking at it right? Do you think that's right? Well, the answer here is found as to where the psalmist customarily went for advice in verse 24. Your testimonies are my delight and my counselors. Now, you'll find, if you go back, in fact, I think we'll study this a little later, and you'll make your way through the early references to the Ten Commandments, they are called the testimony of God. And the Ark is called the Ark of the Testimony. We're accustomed to calling it the Ark of the Covenant, but in fact, it's the Ark of the Testimony, and it's the Ark of the Testimony because the testimony of God was inside of it. And the testimony of God was the Ten Commandments. Question number 5, can sin, lying, for example, become a way of life? Verse 29, remove from me the way of lying. So there is a way of doing things, a way of going about your life that can become a way of life. Sin is such a way, and lying is such a way. Now, question number 6, is there an alternate way of life? Well, of course there is, but let's take a look at what it is called in verses 30 through 33. I have chosen the way of truth. Your judgments have I laid before me. I have stuck unto your testimonies, O Lord. I can see the Velcro where it bounces. You bounce against it and you stick to it. It's there. It's yours. I have stuck to them. Don't put me to shame. I will run the way of your commandments when you shall enlarge my heart. Okay, there is a way of sin. There is a way of lying. But there's an alternative way. And it's a way that is described by the commandments, and it's called the way of truth. And truth is a synonym for God's law. Question number 7, is there a way to achieve liberty? Now, one of the most fundamental things, the most fundamental desires and wants and needs of human beings is to be free from external restraint. We don't want to be in handcuffs. We don't want to be in shackles. We don't want to be locked up in a room somewhere. We don't want to be in a prison where we can't go and come as we want. We want to be free. Is there a way to achieve liberty and to be free? Well, it must be. What is it? The answer is verse 45. I will walk at liberty because I seek your precepts. So it's really conflicting to say that the law is a yoke of bondage, or that the law somehow puts one in shackles, or locks a person up, or keeps a person from doing things they might enjoy or might have some pleasure in, because the psalmist comes along and tells us, well, the way that I seek And I find liberty is by seeking God's precepts. It's the way I keep myself out of trouble. It's the way I keep myself on the right. I can't stay out of jail by keeping your law. Number eight. Question number eight asks you to describe the relationship between going astray and being afflicted, and it refers you to two verses, verses 67 and verse 71. Verse 67, actually taking verse 66 along with it, teach me good judgment and knowledge, for I have believed your commandments. What I want to learn from this is how to have good judgment when I face a life situation, when I face a turning in the road, when I come to a place where I have to decide between one or two or three alternatives before me. I really want to have good judgment. Where do I get it? He says, I believe your commandments. Then in verse 67, he says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I have kept your word. That actually there is a natural result of breaking God's law in the sense that we get into trouble. There are consequences that go along with it. You tell people lies, and pretty soon nobody's going to believe you anymore. They will suspect you at every turn. So the ostracization, the putting away from society, the people not trusting you and not wanting to be with you because you're a liar or you're a thief or you're just not a trustworthy person is a kind of affliction. And having said this, he says that before I was afflicted, I went astray. But when I was afflicted, then I learned some things. I actually turned and I began to keep your word. Verse 71, it is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Now, the fact of the matter is that, as it says in question number 9, to what end might God afflict or chastise a man? Verse 71 is it cited. It also refers you to Hebrews 12, verses 6 through 11, which are the classic verses about God's chastisement and how God chastises children he loves. Now, there are three significant things that can happen as a result of sin. One of them is the consequences of the sin. In other words, you tell a lie to a person, they find out about it, and they don't trust you anymore. That's a consequence, and you lose something in the process of doing that. The second thing that can happen is chastisement. In other words, God looks down upon you, and God takes some kind of action to put your feet back right. He sends adversity your way. He puts a stumbling block in front of you so that you fall over and pick yourself up and say, wait a minute, I've done something wrong. I've made a wrong turn. The third thing that happens is punishment. That's what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah when God came down and rained fire and brimstone down on them and destroyed all of them. It's what happens in the lake of fire, ultimately, when sinners are destroyed. We hope that that doesn't really face or threaten any of us right now. We've got to deal with those first two. One is consequences, and the second one is chastisement. And Hebrews tells us you shouldn't faint or get downhearted when God chastises you. I realize it's not pleasant. But the truth is, if you believe that God is chastising you, if you believe something bad happened to you in your life because you broke God's law, rejoice. God deals with you as a son. It's like God told you not to run out in the street. You ran out in the street, so he comes out and grabs you and takes you back in the yard and paddles your little bottom and says, don't you go out in the street again. I told you not to do that. Because in going out in the street, you're likely to get run over. You know, some 18-wheeler can come along and enforce your father's law in a way you didn't actually anticipate. It has consequences. You know, this is a really good little analogy for one of the great problems we run into in life. We're gamblers. We break God's law once, and there are no consequences that we can discern. It seems that we got away with it. We got away with it in the same way a little toddler runs out in the street and his dad runs out and grabs him and jerks him up and puts him back in the yard, got away with it. He didn't get away with it. It's just that that particular occasion, the consequences didn't come down on him. But if he keeps doing it enough, sooner or later, some car, some 18-wheeler is going to come along and enforce, if that's the word we must use for it, his father's law. Not really. That's not what happens. It exacts the consequences. And so we think that when we break God's law and we seem to get away with it, nothing happens. Well, maybe the law is not in effect. Maybe the law is not important. But the truth is, God does afflict. God does chastise to teach us lessons. But a lot of times he doesn't do anything. And a lot of times we think we are getting away with it, when in truth, we're not. Question number 10. Can a man depend on God's commandments to steer him right? This time we look at verse 86. All your commandments are faithful. Now, what does faithful mean? Well, something that's faithful means you can depend on it. The fact is that God's commandments are faithful. You can depend on them. They are not going to steer you down the wrong path. Next question, number 11. How long can God's word be expected to last? This time, verse 89. Verse 89 says, "Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven." How long? Well, as long as it takes. Forever. We can play games, I suppose, with the meaning of words, but why not just take it as it says? Number 12. How might a man become wiser than his enemies? Verse 98. We'll start with verse 97. Oh, how I love your law. It's my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, have made me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. Now, there's seems like for a man like David, especially, his enemies were always there. How might he become wiser than them? Well, by meditating on God's law, by considering the commandments, by thinking about them, by applying them to his life, by applying them to the odd situation that he was running into from time to time with someone who was his enemy. Note now, it should be made plain that the law of God in all of its parts is a rich source of wisdom and knowledge. As you read along through this psalm, it becomes very apparent that what happens from the law is you get wisdom, you get knowledge, you get understanding, you gain a depth and a grasp of life situations, you get tools with which to make decisions, and the truth is that you really do come to grow as a result of knowing God's law. Now, why would God abolish something that was designed to convey basic wisdom? The building blocks of knowing how to live a life. Here they are, all laid out for us, and that's what the purpose of the law is. Why on earth would we do it away with it? How could such a law become obsolete? How can we say that modern man has no need of all the things that David, the psalmist, received from this law? I don't need wisdom. I don't need to be smarter than my enemies. I don't need somebody to explain all these things to me. Well, I do, and I think you would agree that you do too. So when you understand, and this is one of the most fundamental things to understand, is that there is a purpose behind the law, and the purpose is to convey wisdom, knowledge, understanding, and to help a man know how to live his life, to help a young man clean up his act, to set our feet in a right path, and to get us going in the way that we really ought to go. Number 13. Many people consider the law to be a burden. Why did the psalmist say that these words, which others think are a burden, are as sweet as honey to him? Verses 103, he says, "How sweet are your words to my taste, yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, and I hate every false way." Now, there is a true way, and there is a false way. And the law of God, the commandments, the precepts, the statutes, the judgments, and all the stuff that we've been reading about, define the true way. And so he said, I get understanding through these things, and I hate every false way, because those false ways lead me to get hurt. As a result of seeing all this, he said, oh my, the words of God, the commandments of God are sweeter than honey to my mouth, to my taste. Number 14, when a man walks in darkness, how can he find his way, or how can he light his way? Now, the theme of walking in darkness can just simply be a reference to the way a man has to live his life. We come up against decisions. We come up against life situations that we just do not know what to do about. How do I deal with this? How do I handle this? The psalmist says in verse 105, "Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." And this is not a burden laid upon that somebody has got to carry that just loads them down. This is something that actually shines a light on the road in front of you and lights your feet where you're putting them so you don't stumble over things. This is the purpose behind the law. It is curious that people think of it as something to control, something that binds them. It's like shackles. It's like handcuffs. It's a limiting thing. No, it's not. It's a light. It's a lamp. It reveals things. And in fact, this is the purpose of the law, to reveal. To reveal to us the difference between right and wrong. To reveal to us what works and what doesn't. And so the psalmist continues. Would men, he asks, ever attempt to make void the law of God? Question number 15 this time. And the answer, verse 126. It is time for you to work, Lord, for they have made void your law. And for some strange reason, and it is hard to grasp why people do it, they just want to get rid of, make void, abolish, lay aside the law of God. The psalmist didn't understand it. He didn't understand it because he understood what the purpose of the law was. Question number 16. What is there to divide right from wrong? Is there a false way? This time, verse 128. Therefore, I esteem all your precepts concerning all things to be right, and I hate every false way. Yes, there is a false way. And that false way is a way that can get you hurt. It can take you in a wrong direction. It can take you someplace you don't need to go. And in truth, when you understand what's there, you're not going to want to know. It is the law of God that makes the difference between a true way and a false way. Number 17, how long will God's law last? Verse 142, your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness. And your law is the truth. Now, if it's truth, it's truth. It isn't true today and false tomorrow. It is a true way. Trouble and anguish, he said, has taken hold on me, but your commandments are my delight. The righteousness of your testimonies is everlasting. Give me understanding, and I will live. And the reason why these things are everlasting is because they are founded on the nature of things. In other words, it's in the nature of man that if we lie to one another and we break down the barriers of trust between us, it hurts us. It's going to hurt us today. It hurt us yesterday. It's going to hurt us tomorrow. And it's going to keep on hurting right on out through till the last man no longer exists. The righteousness of your testimonies, the rightness of them, the fact that they're correct and that they work is everlasting. It's not going to go away as long as man has not gone away. Later, in number 152, verse 152, he says, concerning your testimonies, I have known of old that you have founded them forever. Verse 160, your word is true from the beginning, and every one of your righteous judgments. Now, mind you, we've gone beyond the commandments here. Now we're all the way down to the judgments, which are applications of commandments to life, to situations in life. He said these things endure forever. So that as long as the whatever it is the judgment applied to exists, if it recurs in the future, it will still be true. There is a right way, there is a wrong way, and it isn't going to change. Now, I draw the note for you here that many of the Psalms are laid out in couplets. A couplet is two parallel statements that say the same thing in different ways. Coupled this way, thy righteousness is synonymous with thy law, as they are in these verses. We will also see later the righteousness defined as, quote, all your commandments. Number 18, what is the biblical basis of righteousness? Verse 172, my tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteousness. So the biblical basis of what's right and what's wrong, if you just say, I want to be a righteous person, then what defines that righteousness is the keeping of God's commandments. Now, when you become a sinner, when you've broken the commandments and you're guilty of them, you can't get rid of your guilt and be made righteous before God by commandment keeping. Commandment keeping keeps you from being a sinner. It doesn't make you right when you already are one. For that, you need the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But the biblical basis of righteousness, that which describes what it is and what it's not, is the law. The next passage of Scripture in this study is Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 through 33, basically a study of the entire fifth chapter of Deuteronomy. This chapter is the one that has the other statement of the Ten Commandments, very much the same as the one in Exodus 20 with a few minor variations. What we're after when we go here this time, though, is a little something different from what the Ten Commandments said. They're familiar enough to all of us. Question number 19, who was it who wrote the Ten Commandments and what was his name? Well, it's very evident as you make your way through here that the one that wrote the Ten Commandments, the one that actually used his finger to write them, his name is Jehovah. The Lord himself wrote them. Number 20, did the people make any promises to God relative to the law? Well, yes, they did. They said, now to Moses, you go near, verse 27, and you hear everything that the Lord our God says, and speak to us all the Lord our God shall speak to you, and we'll hear it, and we will do it. So yes, they did make some promises. Number 21, did God think they would be able to fulfill their promise? Well, unfortunately, no. He did say that they meant well. In verse 28, he says, the people have well spoken what they have said. They mean it. Their heart is in it. They'd like to do it. But he also has to own up to the fact that they are not going to be able to do it. He says in verse 29, oh, that there were such an heart in them. The heart just wasn't there. They meant well. They would like to keep the commandments. They meant to keep the commandments. But the truth is, God knew that they were not going to do so. Now, there's a big distinction here, though, between saying that they really weren't going to be able to do it, and on the other hand, saying that any one aspect of the law was something that they could not do. Because the truth is, I mean, it's within the scope of a man's work or his efforts not to steal. A lot of people go through a great deal of their life and never so much as pick up anything that belongs to another human being. So it's not that any aspect of the law by itself was impossible. Every aspect of it was within reach to them. The problem was that the normal human selfishness, the human way of doing things, the wants and the desires that all of us have, basically make it impossible for us to go through life and not break some laws in the process of getting through life. Now, what did God say would be the result if Israel did keep the law, if they were able to do so? In verse 29, he says, oh, that there were such a heart in them, that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. So, what's the result of keeping the law? Your life works. It's that simple. And what's the result of breaking the law? Your life doesn't work. It's that simple. And God says, I wish they had the heart in them to do it, because if they did, their lives would just be a lot better. But he knew that they didn't have the heart, and consequently they wouldn't do it. Not because it was impossible, because it was very possible in all of its parts, but their heart just wasn't right. Question number 23, is there any reason to believe that the results of keeping these commandments would be any different today from what it was then? In other words, if they would just hear me and keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children. No, there's no reason to believe that keeping the commandments today would result in any different result at all. Now we turn to the 19th Psalm, and we come across a surprise, something we might not have expected. Number 24, can the law play any role in converting a person? Well, if you start in verse 7, it says, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, and more to be desired than fine gold. Yea, the sweeter than honey to the honeycomb. We ask the question, can the law play any role in converting a person? Well, sure it can. The fact of the matter is that the law is what makes the simple person wise. In other words, you go along like a dumb person, sinning, breaking things, falling over things, hurting yourself and hurting the people around you. And you come up against God's law. Now, the word convert simply means to change. So, if we talk about changing a person, of course it can. If you come to learn that God's law says, thou shalt not steal, and you stop stealing, you have been changed by the law. Maybe you were afraid of God. Maybe you'd be afraid God was going to get you. Or whatever motivation it was, the truth is that the law does change a person's life. And that's all it means when it says, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. It does it, as it says in verse 11, by them is your servant warned, and in keeping of them there is great reward. Because they work. They warn you against evil. They keep you from doing things that hurt. Now, I make the note in the lesson that we all know the law cannot justify a man or grant salvation, but conversion, well, conversion is merely a change. It's not justification. The question here is whether the law can effect a change in a man's life. Also note in this passage the use of parallelism. Verses 7, 8, and 9 are couplets, that is, two statements coupled together, which make the same point in different words with parallel sentence structure. Question number 25. In this passage are listed several different results from keeping the law of Jehovah in one of its forms or another. See how many of these results you can list. Well, they're fairly straightforward. One is the result is the changing of the life. It makes a simple person wise is another one. They rejoice the heart, make you happy. They actually make you feel better about your life and the way things are. They enlighten your eyes in verse 8. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. He goes on to say later that they warn the servant in verse 11, and there is great reward. So you can list them off. There are several different benefits, different results from keeping the law of God. Now, number 26, considering the purpose of the law in all of its forms, laws, commandments, statutes, and judgments, can you think of any reason why it should be abolished? Can you think of any reason why it should be considered obsolete? Now, bear in mind that what we're doing here is we're thinking about the law in terms of the results that it produces. The purpose of the law. Why did God give it in the first place? Well, He gave it to us to show us the difference between right and wrong. At what point in history or in a man's life does he no longer need to know the difference between right and wrong? Number 27. Are there any different levels of sin suggested here? Well, in fact, there are. He mentions in verse 13, keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Now, in saying this, there is a presumption that there are some sins that aren't presumptuous, if I may say it that way. It runs counter to reason, in fact, to think that all sins are the same, even though we know if you've broken one commandment, you're guilty of all, and we've heard all of that. But not all sin is committed in the sense of presumptuousness. Some are committed in ignorance, some are committed in weakness. And again, verse 13 says that there is a great transgression. And if there's a great transgression, then there must be transgressions that are not so great. Turning now to Matthew 22 and verses 34 through 40. Question number 28, what is the first great commandment? Well, they came to Jesus and asked him in verse 36, Master, which is the great commandment of the law? Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. Question number 29, what is the second great commandment? Well, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's easy. Question number 30, what is the relationship between these two great commandments and the rest of the law? The relationship is that the entirety of the rest of the law hangs on these two great commandments. Or putting it another way, they are the two big foundation stones upon which the entire structure of the law is built. Every bit of the law, all of it, hangs on these. Now, in saying that all the law hangs on these two great laws, Jesus established the basis of the law. The law is rooted in the love of God and the love of nature. I'm sorry, the love of neighbor. It grows out of the way things are, out of the nature of things. There is a human nature and there is a divine nature. Part of the law teaches man how to love his neighbor, while the rest teaches him how to love God. Now, question number 31 should be obvious. Could a law rooted in the nature of things be readily abolished? Well, no, not unless the nature of things is changed. Now, if you can change the nature of a man, or if you can change the nature of God, well, then maybe some change in the law would be called for. But if the law grows out of the way things are, well, the law is not going to change because all it is doing is describing what is right and what is wrong, and that, after all, is the purpose of the law. Now, many people, when they get around finally to reading the Bible all the way through from beginning to end, usually get somewhere in the first few chapters of Leviticus and give up. It becomes defeating to them. But in fact, there's some very interesting things in here. Take, for example, the section beginning in Leviticus 7, verses 22 through 25. Question number 32, what possible reason could God have had for prohibiting the eating of fat? Well, now, unless you just arrived here from another planet, if you watch the news and if you read your papers and also, you know that in recent years there has been an enormous amount of advance in medical knowledge of the dangers of eating fat, of what fat does in a person's diet, and how it clogs up a human being's arteries. The whole idea of eating fat, well, why would God stop you from eating fat? Was it because he cares about his own arteries? Number 33, was there any discipline connected with this law? Well, yes, there was. The person that ate fat was cut off from among his people. Well, I suppose you could look at somebody today who's been eating fat a great deal of his life, and it's not going to be very long before he's going to be cut off in the middle of his people. He's going to have a heart attack, his arteries are going to be clogged up, and he's going to die. Now, in question number 34, when we eat fat, do we in any way harm God? Well, of course not. God doesn't have arteries, not like we do at least, and eating fat, me eating fat, isn't going to clog up God's arteries. And so consequently, in telling me not to eat fat, and then I go contrary to it and eat fat, who am I hurting? Well, I'm surely not hurting God. Now, I made the note in the lesson that God did not bother to tell the Israelites that eating fat would clog their arteries. They probably would have just said, well, Lord, what's an artery? Because they didn't know that much. There's a lot of things that they didn't know. A lot of things that would have hurt them if they had done them that God told them not to do and actually disciplined them like you might discipline your child for doing. We tell our child, don't run into the street. And then we discipline the child for running into the street. It's really just as simple as that. Because unless there is an immediate effect from doing something wrong, we think there is no effect. And so we'll eat fat, and we'll smoke, and we'll do all kinds of things, and we'll burn the candle at both ends in our lives and not get our rest, and we just go right on thinking, well, I got away with it that time, I'll get away with it the next time. So God comes along with some discipline. He simply told them not to eat the fat, warned of discipline if they did. It's not dissimilar to some parental warnings to children when they say, well, Daddy, why? The answer, because I told you so. I wish I had a nickel for every time I'd heard that as a child. The law serves as a good illustration of the idea behind law in general. Many people tacitly accept an arbitrary God theory, that is, to say that God arbitrarily made this act wrong and that act right. I mean, he could just as easily have said, you shall eat fat, as he could have said, you shall not eat fat. They don't realize that God said so because eating fat hurts. It's wrong. The theory of the arbitrary God theory allows that God could just as easily said, thou shalt commit adultery, and we could have all had a lot more fun chasing one another's wives instead of chasing our own. But what if it's the other way around? What if the reason God said an act is wrong is because it really is wrong? It's wrong because it hurts someone. It's wrong to eat fat, not because it shortens God's life, but because it shortens yours. Now, we pass on from there to Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1. The reason we're going through this is because there are some that assume that the law came into existence with Moses and then ended with Jesus Christ, and we have to establish a little more permanent basis for the law than that. In Genesis 4, we come to question number 35. The question is, what is sin? 1 John 3:4, sin is the transgression of the law. Question number 36, did Cain commit sin? You bet he did. Was there then a law? Yep, I'm afraid so. So consequently, since sin is a transgression of a law, and Cain committed sin, then we know there was a law in existence at the time. Question number 37, was there a law regulating offerings? Well, of course there was. If there hadn't been, what's the difference in one offering or another? The truth is that one man did what God expected, the other man did not. Question number 38, what was done with the fat of the offering? Was it eaten? No, it wasn't. Isn't it interesting how someone might presume that that law in Leviticus, well, that's just an old covenant law. That's a Levitical law. That's all done away with. We don't have to think about that anymore. But the truth is, it's older than that. It's older than that because man is older than that. The law itself is as old as it is because of the way man's bloodstream and his body chemistry works. Question number 39, was it a sin to commit murder? Yes. Question number 40, Can there be transgression without law? Well, Romans 4:15 says that sin is not imputed when there is no law. So we know what? Well, we know that there was a law in existence at the time. Was sin imputed to Cain? Question number 41, yes, it was. Question number 42, can sin be imputed when there is no law? Back to Romans chapter 5, verses 12 and 14 again. No, sin cannot be imputed when there is no law. So was there a law? Yes. Question number 43, was there a law against doing whatever they were doing in Sodom and Gomorrah? This is a family course, so I guess we shouldn't discuss that in a great deal detail. Well, Genesis 18:20 says that there was a law against it, that they were sinners before the Lord exceedingly. You don't get to be sinners before the Lord unless you're breaking a law somewhere. Was there a law in number 44, was there a law in Abraham's day against taking another man's wife? The reference, Genesis 20, verses 1 through 9? Yes, it was. Question number 45, was adultery a sin in Joseph's day? Yes, it was. Question number 46, was there a complete set of known laws in Abraham's day? Genesis 26:5 says what? Abraham kept my commandments, my statutes, my laws. There was not merely law, there was a structured system of law in existence in Abraham's day long before Moses that defined the difference between right and wrong and told a man how to live his life. Question number 47. Did the law of God then exist before Moses? Well, of course it did. Now, why then do men call it the law of Moses, and what role does Moses play in all of this? This takes us to Deuteronomy 31, verses 22 through 27. Who wrote the law, the words of the law into a book? Well, Moses did. He actually sat down and wrote them all up on papyrus, or on a vellum type material, and they were bound together probably into a scroll. Number 49, who actually wrote the Ten Commandments? Well, we've already seen that God did that, that Jehovah did that. Now, is there another term for the law of Moses? Yes, there is. Check the two references, and you'll find that the law of Moses is also called the law of the Lord, or if you notice that Lord is in small caps, that indicates that the Hebrew word there is Jehovah. It is the law of Jehovah. Question number 51. Did the law of Jehovah involve ceremonies? Yes, it did. The reference is there for you. Question number 52. Did the law of Moses involve ceremonies? Yes, it did. The law of Moses and the law of Jehovah are, for all practical purposes, synonyms. The law Moses wrote in the book was the law that Jehovah gave him. All Moses did was to codify existing law and to convey the specific application of those laws to the community of Israel. And this is where some of the confusion comes in between Old Covenant, New Covenant ideas. That what Moses, and what people often mean when they speak of the law of Moses, is the law of God as applied to Israel. And to be sure, there are aspects of that law that, as they were applied to Israel, won't work in our modern society because things are different. One of the classic examples of it, which we could study, is that there were laws in the law of Moses regulating slavery. Slavery was practiced in that world. It needed to be regulated. Slavery is not practiced in our world, so you can't keep some of those laws because you don't have slaves to apply those laws to. Now we come to Romans 5, verses 12 through 14, and I take you through a rather detailed analysis of this short passage because it is so important that we understand what it's talking about. Question number 53, who was the one man by whom sin entered the world? Well, it was Adam, of course. Number 54, what is sin? Sin is the transgression of the law. Now, when did this happen? Number 55, well, it happened almost immediately. It happened in the Garden of Eden. It happened before the world ever got started. Number 56, what rule or law was broken? Well, God said, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of this one tree you can't eat. What causes death to pass on all men? Now, let's take a hard look at this because there is an assumption that many people make that Adam's sin caused death to pass upon all men. But what did Paul say? He said, wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death entered by sin, And so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. In other words, death passes upon all men, not because Adam sinned, but because we all sin. That's how we get guilty of death. Adam was merely the door by which sin entered. But the death passed upon us because we did the same things Adam did. Not necessarily eating of the same tree, but we went contrary to what God told us to do. We broke the law. Now, number 58, when Paul uses the phrase, until the law, to what time period is he referring? Well, to read what he says. He said, death passed upon all men, for all have sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. Now, what is this saying? Plainly, when he says death reigned from Adam to Moses, his expression for until the law is talking about until the law of Moses. Until we came to that time when the law was all codified and the old covenant ratified and they all began to live under that particular covenant. Until the law, sin was in the world. How do we know this? Well, we've just gone over several instances that show us prior to Moses that there was sin and that it was wrong to break certain laws at that time. Now, Paul says, sin is not imputed when there is no law. What is he trying to tell you? Well, he's trying to tell you that until the law of Moses, the law was there anyway, because the sin could not be imputed if there had not been a law. Was the sin imputed? You bet it was. If it had not been, death would not have reigned from Adam to Moses. And it reigned even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him to come. Do you realize what he is saying? He is saying it's not Adam's sin that made all those people guilty. There was a law in existence at that time. What law might that have been? Well, it was the law of Jehovah, the law of the Lord, the law of God, if you will, which found later expression as the law of Moses. But Paul is making the point that people had sin imputed in them, and death reigned during that period of time over people who didn't do what Adam did. Therefore, there had to have been a law that they were breaking. Number 59, what causes or allows death to reign? Well, sin does. You commit sins. Number 60, we know there was sin before Moses because Adam sinned. Were there other kinds of sin? Sure there were. We've already gone through the list. Number 61, can death pass upon a man when sin is not imputed? No, it can't. Number 62, can sin be imputed to a man when there is no law? No, it can't. Number 63, can we say then that there was a full-blown set of laws that existed before Moses ever came on the scene? Yes, we can. We have it from Genesis, and we now have it from Romans. Number 64, why should we conclude that those laws back then were very different from the laws given to Moses? Well, the answer is that we really should not think it's very different, because they are rooted once again in the nature of man. The nature of man was the same when Paul wrote as it was when Moses wrote, and also before Moses ever came along. Now, as long as we are in Romans and reading Paul, it might be useful to examine what he has to say about the purpose of the law. And that's where some of the really interesting aspects of this come in. In Romans 3, reading in verses 19 through 31, who, according to Paul, is under the law? Number 65. Well, if you read verse 19, it says the whole world, everybody. If you listen to some people, you would think, well, it's the Jews. They were the ones that were under the law, but not according to Paul. Number 66, to whom does the law speak? Well, take a look at the way it's worded in here. Now, we know that whatever thing the law says, it says to those who are under the law. It speaks to people who are under the law. That every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Everybody. Okay, to whom does it speak? Everybody. Why does the law speak? So the whole world will know they're guilty. If they didn't tell them about it, they wouldn't know. They wouldn't realize that they were making mistakes. Number 68, who on the whole is affected by the speaking of the law? Everybody. Number 69, would you say then that it's only the Jews who were under the law? Or is the whole world in that condition? Well, there's not much to rejoice in that when the whole world is in that condition, according to this passage in Paul. Number 7, is it possible to be justified by the deeds of the law? No way. It's utterly impossible, according to Paul. Number 71, what is the purpose of the law, then, if it's not justification? Surprising how many people get confused about this. By the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight, because that's not the purpose of the law. By the law is the knowledge of sin, which is what we've been reading about all the way through the Old Testament. The very purpose of the law is so we'll know what's the difference between right and wrong. Number 72, what does Paul mean by the righteousness of God in verse 21? If you compare the first clause of verse 21 with the first clause of verse 20, keep parallelism in mind. Basically, what he's talking about is the righteousness of God that passes upon people by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. You can't do it by keeping the law. That's not what the law is for. The law is to tell you when you're wrong so that you can be made right by Jesus Christ. How is the righteousness of God achieved? Verse 22. The righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ unto all and upon all them that believe. That's not hard. Question number 74. How is justification achieved? Verse 24. Being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Justification is the wiping out of sins and guilt from the past, and the law can't do anything about that. What is, then, the relationship between the righteousness of God and justification? Well, the righteousness of God is achieved by justification through the grace through the blood of Jesus Christ. 76. Do you find a working definition of justification in this passage? Yes, you do. You can find it here quite definitely. It is the forgiveness of sins that are past. Number 77, what role does the law play in justification? None. All the role the law plays is to make you aware that you need to be justified. It can't do it for you. Number 78, was there a different mode of justification for Gentiles from that of Jews? No. Number 79, since the law is not efficacious for justification, in other words, it can't do it for you, is the law then made void or done away? No. Of course not. It's a silly question, because that's not what the law was for in the first place. It was to tell us how to live a life. Romans 4 now, verses 1 through 15. Question number 80, was there a different means of justification in the Old Testament from the New? No way. Question number 81, was Abraham made righteous by deeds of the law? No way. Number 82, can justification ever be something that God owes us because we have carried out certain works? No way. Not possible. Was it for Abraham? No. 83, what is involved in imputing righteousness? What is involved in it is forgiving iniquities and sins so that a person is no longer held guilty of transgression. Number 84, did circumcision play any role in Abraham's justification? No, it didn't. His circumcision was given after he was justified, and he was justified by faith. Was it efficacious or even conditional to his justification? No, the justification was accomplished before him. Number 85, why did God make it a point to justify Abraham before circumcision? Well, the answer to that is pretty plain when you look at what is written in verses 11 and 12. He received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had, being yet uncircumcised. Why? So he could be the father of all them that believed, even of those who are not circumcised, so that righteousness could be imputed to them as well. So circumcision has nothing to do with justification or making a person righteous before God. Galatians 2. Verses 11 through 21, number 86. According to Paul, what did the Jews by nature know about the means of justification? This may surprise you, but the Jews knew that justification was by grace and not by works of law. Number 87, did anyone think there was one method of justification for the Jews and another for the Gentiles? No. 88, could either Jew or Gentile be justified by the works of the law? No, they couldn't. Number 89, was there ever a time when one could be justified by the works of the law?